9 minutes past 4, the 3rd of July, and I'm in Barcelona, specifically down on the seafront, pretty close to where the Tour de France is going to start tomorrow. But I'm standing in front of a curious-looking building, an oval structure with a skin of horizontal wooden slats, quite a unique-looking place. And why am I here? Seems like an odd location to start a series about the 2026 Tour de France and about how France might finally win the Tour again, if not this year, then sometime in the near future. The reason is this. Almost 20 years ago, this building became the repository for the fate of professional cycling itself. On the eve of the 2006 Tour de France, the biggest doping scandal in the sport's history broke, Operación Puerto. Two of the favourites, Ivan Basso and Jan Ulrich, were caught up in it and sent home, along with several other riders and teams. They were allegedly, and in many cases it turned out to be true, linked to a Spanish doctor, Eufemiano Fuentes, and his particular method of performance enhancement, i.e. blood transfusions. Over 200 bags of blood were seized from Fuentes' properties and those of his accomplices, and this is where we get to the building behind me. They ended up here at the Hospital del Mar Research Institute, which overlooks the Mediterranean in this beautiful setting where I'm standing. What, you may ask, does it have to do with Paul Cercas and the 2026 Tour de France? Well, in planning this series, I wanted to go back and understand, or try to understand, why it's taken France so long, 41 years, to find a successor to Bernard Hinault. And the events of Operación Puerto in 2006 have a great deal to do with that drought. Last night we were in the middle of Barcelona at the team presentation under the magnificent spires of the Sagrada Familia, Gaudi's masterpiece, of which he once said, "My client is not in a hurry," meaning God. Well, the French have certainly been in a hurry to find their successor to Hinault. Now, talking of long waits, you might be wondering what happened to those blood bags and whether I'm about to march into the hospital and pull them out of a freezer in some dusty corner. I'm afraid that's not going to happen. They were kept here for around 13 years. 211 bags in total, and over the years there was a lot of speculation about identifying which riders or other sports people they belonged to. Fuentes himself, of course, had hinted that athletes from other sports were involved too. Finally happened in 2019, WADA took the bags away for analysis and 11 individuals were identified as owners, but by then the statute of limitations had run out. So as far as I'm aware, there are no more blood bags here at the Hospital del Mar in Barcelona. But the legacy of Operación Puerto lives on, particularly, as I'm about to explain, for French cycling. Ça revient, it's coming home, how France will win the Tour again, is a Kilometre Zero series written and produced by me, Daniel Frieber. Ad-free versions of these episodes will be available exclusively for friends of the Cycling Podcast. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com to sign up as a friend of the podcast, and please remember that by doing so, you are enabling us to cover the Grand Tours on the ground and produce these special series and episodes. Eight years before Puerto, the Festina scandal in 1998 had been dubbed the greatest doping controversy in professional sport, but also a new dawn for cycling. Festina were themselves a French-run outfit, with a French talisman in Richard Virenque, and there was certainly no suggestion that the home nation of the Tour, its riders and teams, represented an island of purity in a sport by then drowning in dishonesty.
La deuxième partie du Tour de France, comme leur sept autres coéquipiers de chez Vestina, ils ont été contraints d'abandonner après leur.
There was though a real feeling that the French regarded and reacted to Vestina as an existential threat, much more than neighbouring countries, and with good reason. For in the wake of their doping apocalypse came not only moral disgrace, but an anti-doping law with increased police powers. Just as using EPO had once looked like the only available means to survive, so suddenly was not using it. The best gauge of how much the French peloton had cleaned up its act came in their results, especially at the Tour. The term cyclisme à deux vitesses, or two-speed cycling, was soon coined, shorthand for the gulf between the reformed dopers or rare paragons of virtue and those who had carried on regardless, between the French and the incorrigible rest. A former Festina rider, Christophe Moreau, was the highest placed French finisher for 3 years in a row between 2003 and 2005 without ever threatening the top five. But in 2004, hope had also sprung from an unlikely source. In an interview with AS newspaper, Spanish rider Jesus Manzano laid bare the shocking scale of the doping he had witnessed and committed at the Kelme team. In doing so, he provided the most damning overview yet of life in the post-Festina peloton. Manzano, a journeyman with a wayward reputation, was easy to discredit, and duly was by defenders of the status quo. But not by one Spanish magistrate, Antonio Serrano, who nearly 2 years later began surveillance of individuals heavily incriminated by Manzano's claims. They included the Canarian doctor, Eufemiano Fuentes. Eventually, after several weeks of phone tapping and fishing in rubbish bins, the magistrate thought he had enough evidence to act. Fuentes was arrested as he left a meeting with Manolo Saiz, the manager of the Liberty Seguros team. Saiz and several of Fuentes' suspected accomplices were also taken into police custody. In Italy, the Giro d'Italia was nearing its conclusion, with Ivan Basso the champion-elect. The Italian was also the joint favourite to win the first Tour de France since Lance Armstrong's retirement. Basso shared that billing with Jan Ullrich, Armstrong's favourite whipping boy throughout his seven-year occupation of the Tour. And so Basso and Ullrich headed for the Grand Départ in Strasbourg. But the day before the prologue, they were heading home, as the aftershocks of the Fuentes arrest shattered the terra firma upon which the whole sport had been built for just over a century, aka the Tour de France.
Hello from Strasbourg, welcome to ITV's coverage of the 2006 Tour de France. And I suppose the first thing I should say is that there will be a 2006 Tour de France. It'll be setting off, though, with the smallest field for over 20 years. Instead of 22 teams and 198 riders, we've got 20 teams and 176 riders. It's been a brutal cull this week and one that's cost the Tour some of its top names. But the hope is that it will prevent any more...
Madame, Monsieur, bonsoir. Je vous le disais en titre, orage sur le Tour de France à la veille du prologue. Plusieurs favoris ne seront pas au départ. Jan Ullrich comme une dizaine d'autres coureurs...
Directamente a nadie. Yo he venido aquí a decir que el ciclismo no es el único deporte en el que se toman cosas para mejorar el rendimiento.
Just walking around the Sagrada Familia to the team presentation. It's the 2nd of July in Barcelona. We've got the Gran Salida in 2 days, and thinking about 20 years ago, thinking about Strasbourg, a less grand affair. That time, the team presentation, the riders were sort of ferried to the presentation on boats down the Rhine, and that was supposedly where the first conversations happened between Ivan Basso and, for example, Jan Ullrich's coach Rudy Pevenage about the hot water that they were in. And of course, Basso and Ullrich ended up getting kicked out of that Tour de France. But The name and the face that comes most readily to mind for me when I think back to that weekend is that of Patrice Clerc, the head of ASO, and it was also Christian Prudhomme's, really his first Tour de France. He'd been shadowing Jean-Marie Le Blanc, but his first Tour de France is the main man, the main face of ASO. But I remember standing in the corridor in the Palais des Congrès the next day, just after they'd effectively chucked out Jan Ullrich and Ivan Basso, and Clerc, who's a sort of middle-aged man, and he was wearing a sort of a beige bank manager's sort of suit, but the two of them bowling through the corridor with a kind of air of defiance, and you felt as though Puerto on that day was really rock bottom for professional cycling. Something had to change, and finally these two men were going to make sure that something did change in the Tour de France and in professional cycling. It was a moment of hope. I was young at the time, I was 25 at the time, maybe naive, but I really did feel as though they felt that this simply could not carry on what had been happening in professional cycling for the previous 15 years. And that was the change in my mind. And the face, as I say, of that Grand Départ, from my point of view, was and remains that of Patrice Clerc. We were taking a big risk from a legal standpoint, because if the teams had said they weren't accepting our decision, they weren't going to cave into our demands and leave the Tour, I don't think we would have had much scope to keep them out. I think that ultimately, if they did agree to go without any opposition, without saying anything, it was because all of the incriminated riders and managers knew perfectly well what they'd done. There wasn't one of them who said he was innocent, that it wasn't fair. Not really. They didn't complain, because they knew they'd been caught with their hand in the cookie jar. Most listeners will know the postscript. Floyd Landis rode into Paris in yellow, only to have it torn from his shoulders when, a few days later, it was revealed he had tested positive for synthetic testosterone. Oscar Pereiro inherited the victory. Spain had its first winner since Miguel Indurain. Yet at the same time, paradoxically, a reputation ravaged by what had already leaked out from the Puerto files. Manzano had described a cycling scene so morally bankrupt it beggared belief, of teammates so desensitised to the health risks that those dangers had become a running joke, as when his teammates would moo or bark at each other to signpost whether they had taken banned products designed to treat anemia in dogs or derived from the blood of calves. Once again, Manzano would have been easy to dismiss as a loser, a quack or fantasist, but with time, other corroborating voices emerged. Years later, I'd write a book about Ulrich and interview several Fuentes clients. One of them, Jörg Jaksche, painted a similarly tragicomic picture.
Manolo paid him so much money, yeah, and he said, it's only for us, exclusively, the service of use only at Fuentes. Chiaro, hombre, amigo. Yeah? And then he had still another 50 riders. One day I had this, when he asked, you know, we were planning for the Tour de France, we were planning where to do what, you know, what, yeah, blood transfusion and stuff. And then suddenly he said, like, somewhere I have a program of the Tour de France. And he was always a little bit like, ah. And then he was like, ah, here's a program of the Tour de France on the last page. You know, it was from the official guide of the Tour de France. And you had the map of France. And there were so many signs with number one, number two, number one, 25, number 76. Yeah. You couldn't even see the map of France. And he said, okay, more or less, here's the third stage. So you want to have that? And I, at this moment, I knew that it's not only liberty. For example, I would use like, this was a typical trick, you would use like a Toblerone and then drill a hole in the Toblerone chocolate and the syringe would fit in it. The reason was, if you have a small package of Toblerone and you would fit the syringe in it, at the normal, at the in the fridges at the hotel, they normally have the Toblerone always in it. So we were our criminal minds, we say, it's almost like it's camouflage or whatever. So stuff like that, you know. And then
it was easy to laugh hearing these stories, and laugh Jörg and I did late into a Munich evening. But the reality at the time was no joke. If some of the lawless riders themselves weren't already dying, then cycling and the Tour were sleepwalking towards annihilation.
Hello, I'm Jérôme Pinault. I wrote the 2006 Tour de France. First time we were afraid for our sport, and we were afraid that all the cyclists be pointed by the other people to be doper, be drugger, I don't know how to say, tricheur.
Cheat.
And after, the things was, okay, good. Now it start a new things. We were not so debile before. We saw and we hear some few things and start now a real things and a new career for cycling.
Stop the podcast!
Stop the podcast!
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids, some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
While the French allowed themselves a soupçon schadenfreude, Ulrich's fall from grace also caused the total collapse of the German pro cycling scene. Also, when researching Ulrich, I relived the catalytic and catastrophic moment with someone who saw it all happen. In fact, the American businessman Bob Stapleton had more than just witnessed Ulrich's banishment from the tour. Stapleton's telecommunications company had been acquired by T-Mobile 4 years earlier, after which he'd somehow found himself managing T-Mobile's women's cycling team. Stapleton was only really a visitor to the 2006 men's tour, and yet on the eve of the race, their communications director, Christian Frommert, was asking him to fire Ulrich over the Fuentes links and take over the men's team.
Basically said, well, I don't know if T-Mobile was going to stay in the sport. Would you be willing to consider being more involved if we're willing to, you know, basically give you a high degree of control, get the company directly involved in the team? I said, well, yeah, sure, and I'd like to help. I didn't want them to leave. You know, I knew the impact that they had on the sport in Germany. I knew how much it meant to the people in the company. So sure, I'm willing to help. And they literally...
And this is in the team hotel.
Yeah.
And he's not specified that they're thinking of leaving because Jan is about to be kicked off the
race. Then he tells me. And okay. He basically says, so I say, yeah, and he goes, well, this is what's going to happen.
Right.
He basically said, they tell me, and they say, well, we need to tell Jan. And this is like the day they tell him to go. They say, well, we want you to sit down with Jan.
Like, to you? Yeah.
Right. It's like, I'll sit down with you, but, you know, there's an obvious communication problem. So I sit with them, and the conversation's all in German. I'm getting about 10% of it.
Where was this, in, like, the lobby of the
some
hotel?
In the room of some shitty, like, faux German hotel
in
Strasbourg.
Yeah, it was the Lion d'Or or something. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, there's a compound set up. It's got a gate that goes across it, so people can't get in there. Everything's parked inside.
It was in a rider's bedroom?
No, it was in, I think it was in the bar, and it wasn't, it was not open yet.
Okay.
So I think they send him off. And I remember him walking into the car. There's photos of it. Getting in the car into the team car and driving him off.
Yeah.
Then they call a rider meeting. And I'm sitting in this thing, and it's like the same. I mean, and these guys are, there's a lot of unhappy people.
Right.
They're shocked. They're stunned. They're talking about boycotting the race. They're just all going to leave.
2 months later, Stapleton was announcing at a press conference in Bonn that having packed 8 months of work into two, T-Mobile would effectively be relaunching with a new roster and new staunchly anti-doping philosophy.
There is the requirement that they have to provide DNA testing, which is another kind of big, big differentiation. And if there's any involvement in any illicit activity of any kind, any form of performance enhancement, that their contract can be terminated, and we can pursue a recovery of the money that they've been paid under their contract. So these are quite different features.
The same week, in Lyon, France, a baby boy named Paul Sexas was born. No organisation embodied French cycling more in those years, its travails and its struggle to remain relevant, its unheeded or even derided cries for help, than Marc Madiot's La Française des Jeux. Their 2006 tour had also been emblematic of the era. The team's highest placed rider on GC in Paris was Sandy Cazard in 68th place, 2.5 hours behind Pereiro. Their best result on a single stage was Bernie Eisel's 4th place on stage 6. Years later, Maddio reflected thus on the aftermath of Festina and the soul-searching it had provoked. It was a question of life or death. The debates were long, sometimes angry, but we knew at that moment that cycling in France might actually disappear. The sponsors could have pulled out, the public authorities, the state might have said, right, no more racing on French roads for 5 years. French cycling had looked within, but in order for them to restore respectability, the rest of the sport would also have to change. While bastions of cycling's old world like Spain and Italy hunkered down in denial, major impetus came from individuals like Stapleton and his compatriot Jonathan Vaughters, whose teams put ethics at the front and centre of both their private and public discourse. It would take years, but slowly the French became less isolated, their riders less fatalistic, their performances more competitive. Perhaps most importantly, some of the coping strategies dredged from the post-apocalyptic wreckage of Festina and then Puerto were slowly becoming their strengths. Maddio had himself spent a night in a prison cell in 1998. His own process of introspection and perhaps atonement had brought him to the realisation that if doping was no longer an option, he had to offer his riders a different path, or at least the illusion initially, that they could fight with different means. Part of that pivot in the year 2000 was the appointment of an outsider, an alien in terms of experience and philosophy, with whom it would take Maddio years to finally see eye to eye. Fred Grapp was a sports scientist, a boffin if you will, conversant in languages that Maddio didn't understand and of which he at first struggled to see the value. Watts, VO2 max, coefficients of drag, all numbers that to Maddio meant much less than the ones riders would pin on their backs and, as he said, go au charbon, to the coalface. For it was there, and only there, you saw their value, not on Grapp's spreadsheets. The alliance seemed unlikely to last, and yet here we are, 26 years later, with Maddio in semi-retirement, now more of a spiritual father than team manager, and Grapp still mapping out the future as the Groupama FDJ's director of innovation. On Friday morning, that is the eve of this year's talk, Grapp and I talked about his long journey and French cyclings over the last 20 years.
Avec des gros yeux, c'est qui celui-là, qu'est-ce qu'il vient faire? Et au sein de mon équipe, tu vois, au bout de 3 ans, à peu près, moi je dis à Marc que je veux m'arrêter, quoi. À Marc Maddio, je dis j'arrête, je peux plus.
He recalls that 3 years into his assignment in 2003, he wanted out, not because of doping and the team's riders' inability to compete, but their unwillingness to embrace the data over dogma approach that he was trying to introduce. He imposed an ultimatum. He would only coach riders who agreed to use a power meter. Many refused. But finally, a year before Puerto, he achieved a personal landmark, obtaining a whole Grand Tour's worth of power data for the first time, from Lilian Jégou at the 2005 Giro. Unfortunately, in those years, when Grapp did input his riders' numbers, a grim reality was staring him in the face.
Parce que moi, je l'ai vécu. On savait que pouvait pas gagner. Donc, à un moment donné, on s'était échappé. Tu vois. Moi, je faisais les statistiques et je voyais bien que avec certains coureurs, on pouvait pas.
They said clearly that all his riders could aspire to was breakaways, a few hours of TV time, a lottery ticket. He's not convinced that the advent of the biological passport 2 years after Puerto in 2008 changed too much. Something else that happened that year may have had a bigger impact, at least at La Française des Jeux. Thibaut Pinot was 18 in the summer of 2008, a year younger than Paul Sexas now, when Grapp took him to a pre-Tour de France training camp at Alpe d'Huez, and Pinot dished out beatings to some of the team's elder statesmen. The figures on Grapp's graphs were emphatic. The teenager was perfectly capable of competing with some of the world's best riders. Finally, a penny was dropping, says Grapp. France's state-regulated sports coaching degree programme, STAPS, founded in 1978, had over the years seeded cycling clubs with not just enthusiasts but graduates, real academics who, aided by technology, started to see something that previous generations had ignored. Cycling was no different from other sports, and contrary to old wives' tales about learning le métier, there was no physiological reason why 18 and 19-year-olds couldn't race with and even beat established pros. It also helped that the elite peloton was hopefully no longer jet-fueled by illegal substances. The likes of Pinot, Bardet and Alaphilippe had also obliterated a national inferiority complex. This, in short, is how Fred Krapp explains the emergence of a rider like Paul Sexas and the intoxicating prospect of a not-too-distant French Tour winner.
Et chez les professionnels. Maintenant, le métier, t'arrives chez les pros, il est appris quasiment. Tu vois? Donc la dynamique, elle est nouvelle depuis... depuis quand même plusieurs années maintenant, depuis 6-7-8 ans.
If it does still take a few years by then, Krapp expects, the dominant discourse in cycling will not be around watts per kilo, but a new frontier. The neurophysiological exceptionalism of riders like Sexas and Pogacar, and how the watts on their power meters tell only one fraction of a very complex story. But that is a story for another day, another podcast.
C'est extraordinaire. Et ça, c'est ce qui va se passer dans les 10 prochaines années. Moi, je suis dedans depuis un petit moment. La neurophysiologie de l'effort, c'est passionnant. Les watts que tu as sur le compteur...
On Thursday evening at the team presentation in Barcelona, Sexas looked unruffled for a young man carrying the hopes of a nation.
C'est tout un pays qui s'illusionne avec vous, non? C'est une apparition un peu inattendue, mais avec beaucoup de qualité.
C'est sûr que voilà, j'espère bien performer. Après, ça va être une belle expérience et j'espère que je vais pouvoir donner le meilleur de moi-même avec toute l'équipe.
Mais dans ce moment, tu penses...
A few moments after he and his teammates had stepped off the stage, under the Sagrada Familia's magnificent and now complete spires, one of Decathlon's most experienced heads, Tesh Benoot, talked to me about what he and they had in store.
19 years old, should he be here, should he not be here? I wonder, what did you first think when the announcement, when the choice was made, and has your opinion changed after you've seen the way he's been the last month or so?
Actually not. I think obviously the team wanted to wait the classics, wait for the classics to see how he was performing. But I think then after Liège was pretty clear physically, he's ready. And I also I have the opinion if you wait one more year, two more years to bring him to the Tour, the pressure will only get bigger because by then he will have only one more big races. He will need to handle the pressure the rest of his career. And I think it's now the last year where he can maybe start without the pressure to having to win the Tour or to at least do second or third. If he gets sixth in Paris, we can be really hopeful with a 19-year-old kid. So I think it's not too early in that way.
What's most impressive about him, both on the bike and off it?
On the bike, for me, I saw all the classics. For me, was really crazy to see how we followed on La Redoute, or we followed Tadej on La Redoute. I know which power I pushed last year to. I think I did La Redoute in 4 minutes 30, and they did it in 3:50 or something this year. It's crazy how they went up. And to see he follows Tadej there was really impressive. He surprises almost every race. It's another surprise. And off the bike, I have to say, it's really a normal 19-year-old kid. That's forgetting everything that's around. Yeah. It's also the type of guy that's coming late for meetings and stuff just because he's, I don't know, you say it in English, he's a bit nonchalant. So I think it's also something, a good quality you have for somebody who has that much pressure on his shoulders. I have the feeling he handles pretty well on this moment, yeah.
They should throw him out of the team. If he's late, you can't be late to meetings, come on.
No, it's good to be relaxed. It's better than being there 15 minutes early, I would say. There's enough people around him that are stressed.
There are some who believe that Sexas's biggest challenges over the next 3 weeks will come off the bike rather than on it. And we may have got a taste of that this week. A Decathlon rider who isn't at the Tour, Sander de Pestel, sharing something that Benoot had told him about Sexas on a podcast. And a minor kerfuffle on social media ensuing. A good reminder and warning to everyone in Sexas's orbit, Benoot told me yesterday, of how their lives may be about to change, if they haven't already.
There have been some quotes on social media. I think Sander de Pestel's saying something that you told him about how Paul is working compared to Vingegaard. Can you just clear that up?
I think it was stupid to mention certain things by Sander, what Sander said. I think he also a bit misunderstood what I meant to him on what I wanted to say on training in Sierra Nevada. For me, it's impressive to train with a guy like Paul. And I also said, like, fuck, he's riding fast. I don't know if I saw Jonas training that fast ever. But I mean, cycling is changing. Every team is training harder and harder every year. So it's just, you cannot compare the two things. For me, I was also coming out of injury. Like when I came to Sierra Nevada, the guys were already there for 1 week. It was my second week. When they did the second week, I joined. So it's how you say it. It's something to be, neglected. If you can say it that way, it's nothing meaningful. So everything is about how you perform in the race. And I think Paul had a good preparation apart from his crash in Dauphiné. And we will see from Saturday on how the legs are. He says this in a podcast of an hour, I think. So they pick a one-liner. But yeah. I also told him, yeah, now you need to actually adapt a bit. If you have somebody like Paul in the team, everybody will look under, how you say, the vergrootglas. Anyway... was tripped.
Gaudí also said about the Sagrada Familia that everything in it or about his design was providential, so happening exactly as God intended. The same may apply to Paul Sexas's first Tour de France. A baptism of fire, and a case of the road writing its own gospel.
Ouais, je vais passer d'abord au général, ouais. Et après, on verra comment ça se passe sur la mesure des jours. J'espère que ça va bien se passer.
Ok, merci beaucoup. Donc, on dit à Paul que arrive bien, que encara té una miqueta de mal de la caiguda del Tour, però que de moment es planteja.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
Stop the podcast!
Stop the podcast!
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV Licensing.
Yes, TV Licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids, some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.